We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
The form of the word, when we talk about life savers, people who do rescue and who are willing to rescue others. And great question when you talk about rescuing and saving, salvation, it's rescue from what, rescue to what, and rescue how. And this psalmist is written from the perspective of poverty, about the rescue that is available to us in our human dilemma. And so much of the psalm is about that human dilemma. Before we get too far down the track on it, though, I've asked that we hand out, and it will happen to you now in a few seconds, some blue cards, which are different to the other cards we have today. And if who's going to hand those out, start handing them out while I talk to them, that would be a good thing. They're comment cards that we use every now and then here at Campus Bible Study. We haven't used this year, though, and we're always keen to relate to people as much as we can, and we know that in a university context such as our own, where people have to dash off to 2 o'clock lectures, etc., oftentimes there are questions and queries that people have that they don't get a chance to express and to ask, or answers that they would like to give back to me that they don't really get a chance to express because we don't have the time to put into question times. We also, you'll notice, on the back of it have a prayer. I want to give it out at this time of the year because over the last few months we have been talking about the very nature of being a Christian and what is being a Christian through the Psalms. We've talked about the person of Jesus in the opening studies on Matthew. And so we know that there are people, and especially in the light of Leighton Ford around at the moment, who are at the point of becoming Christians or have in the recent weeks become Christians. And again, we're keen that we get in contact with you so that we can be helpful to you. Now, the rules are very simple. I'm going to ask at the end of the study, not now, at the end of the study, give you time to write some comments, and I would like you to actually be kind to the person next to you. And that is to write something. Because if only those people who want to write something, then they get embarrassed because the people next to them look over their shoulders. And so you all write down something, you know, like apples are green and roses are red, and it's just to help the person next to you. And we drop them in the box at the back. However, if you have a question or a comment you want answered, you'd have to put your name and address up the top. We refuse to contact people who don't give us their name and address. In fact, we promise not to contact you if you don't give us your name and address. But if you do want to enter into dialogue, discussion, question, query, answer and so forth with us, then put your name and address and we're happy to do it. If you just want to make a comment about things, well, that's all right. I read them all yesterday and I'll read them all again today. And we're happy to hear from you and whatever you want to ask or query, your suggestions you would like for Campus Bible Study for next year and this program, and whatever it is that you want to say, there is an opportunity for you. But at the end of the study, I am going to close today with that prayer that's printed on the back, because for very many people, they understand after a while what it is to be a Christian and even how to become a Christian, but don't really have yet the words to put into prayer the ideas of how to become a Christian. And so at the end of the study, we'll offer that opportunity for a few moments with people today. Not that it flows directly out of Psalm 49, although it's by no means inappropriate to this psalm or unattached to it. Well now, that's enough of the cards, blue cards. You can get back to our yellow sheets. And Psalm 49. The psalmist is writing from this perspective, this position of poverty. He's saying, why should I fear, verse 5, when those who trust in great riches and wealth threaten me? And he advises the reader not to be overawed when a man grows rich. It's about the continuing problem of poverty. Now, there are lots of problems of poverty, ill health, lack of shelter, lack of food, lack of clothing. I mean, lots of problems of poverty. But the problem that he has here is that spiritual, personal, psychological problem that goes with poverty. The problems of fear and envy and of alienation. the problem of no value as a person, the problem of anxiety about what the great, the wealthy, the mighty, the power can do to you, the problem of being overawed by them, being anxious about them, being fearful of them. That is, poverty, dreadful as it may be in terms of health and body, poverty is dreadful in terms of its psychological ramifications. The depression that comes with people who are unemployed in our society is very profound, as some of you will discover next year when you can't get jobs. Your whole self-esteem goes down the gurgler. Wealth and poverty divide societies. The haves and the have-nots is a fundamental way of viewing life and the people around about us. It was true in the day of the psalmist, and it's the persistent problem of today. Envy, rivalry, fear, anxiety, distrust are all part of our society and are all exploited by the politicians on the right and on the left as they try and keep that antagonism, maintain that rage between the haves and the have-nots, as the fear and anxiety of union power and the fear and anxiety about employer oppression is used by both sides to try and gain oppressive power. And wealth has its symbols, like in the psalmist, its symbols and its power. The symbols of cars and houses, of holidays and of perks, of credit cards and horses, of hobbies and boats, all the kinds of symbols of being one of the people who have, are clearly displayed and flashed around. There is a marvellous suburb down here called South Maroubra that you need to wander down and see sometimes. When I was a kid, it was a sandhill. Now it's still a sandhill, but it's got these incredible nouveau riche houses built on them, with marvellous pillars and winding staircases and all the other displaying elements of recent wealth, of affluence in its extreme. Houses which are so large that you have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 bedrooms with 2 or 3 people living in the house. I mean, they're marvellous pieces of extravaganza. It's still there. You can still have it. But there is power that does go with wealth. In fact, wealth is a form of power. If not, that's all it is. Power that means the rich are the ones who avoid the courts and the poor are the ones who are thrown into prison. It means that those who are poor do not get as good education as those who are wealthy. It means that the health care is given to not the sick but to the wealthy rather than the poor. It means that it doesn't matter how the government rearranges the distribution of income, the wealthy seem to be able to get more than the poor, even though the poor have greater need. It goes on, the power continues to be expressed. And so how do people cope with it? Well, there are 2 classic ways, of course. Those on the left seek revolution, seek to take over the governmental power, seek to change the very economic structures, seem to bring in the great new age when we will rule the land with equity and justice, and a new form of oppression and tyranny, of course. The other alternative is not to try and change the system, but just to make sure that you win in the system. You don't worry about the system, you don't worry about the other people, you just make sure that you drag yourself out of the bog. You drag yourself out of your poverty. If not you personally, your family. And so many of you can actually indicate your parents' desire for you has got to do with they had a hard time, they lived through the Depression, they went through the World War, they didn't have the educational opportunities, but they have invested everything in you to actually, they've put aside all their wants, all their desires, all their economic aspirations, to invest them in you that their children won't have to go through the poverty that they went through. And that pattern in generation, of course, a typical migrant pattern, and of course for many of us, the overseas students, again a typical pattern, isn't it? It's got to do with my way of coping with the alienation of poverty is by making sure that I'm not poor, making sure that I win in the system. And so much of the educational institution of which we are part now has got to do with making sure that I get ahead. It's got to do with social upward mobility, economic upward mobility, with a little touch of education on the side. Now, many of the cards, yes, they got upset when I was suggesting that people's aspirations at university were fundamentally money and only peripherally educational. All kinds of people think they're here to actually gain learning and understanding, and I'm very pleased for you. I do hope that you'll understand your own hearts better in the days to come. you will find out. If it wasn't a degree offered at the end and there wasn't a safe, secure job, would you go through the 4 years that you're doing now and make the sacrifice just for the sake of education? I really have great doubts that we would be able to get many people at campus Bible study. Because I have doubts that there'd be many people here. It's got a lot to do with economics. Don't fool yourselves on it, but keep the comments coming in. Disagree with me by all means. Think it through. Send us money when you graduate. The psalmist is calling upon people to listen to him. He has a word for all, the low, the high, the poor, the rich. He's got a word of wisdom, as he describes it in verses 3 and 4. A word, a proverb, a riddle. He actually got some understanding that he wants all, rich and poor alike, to hear in the opening 4 verses there. His answer is death. That's his answer. That's the answer he has worked out. He says, let's get back to the reality of life. The reality of life, the one fixed point of which we cannot gainsay, is death. You do not know anything else about your future, but you can be sure of this, you're going to die. And therefore, if this is the one universal phenomenon, if this is the one universal absolute phenomenon, then this is the point from which to try and gain perspective on what life is all about. You find it in other books such as Ecclesiastes or in the book of Proverbs itself. This is a wisdom psalm, like the wisdom literature of the Bible in Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, Song of Solomon, etc. Here's another one, and it's scattered through the Psalms. Here is a wisdom psalm. And the wisdom so frequently of Israel is the wisdom of saying, let's face the facts. There aren't many facts about life, but one undeniable fact is death. Given that, let's try and analyse what life is about. That makes it a fairly depressing psalm. But if you think that's depressing, you haven't heard the Bible study yet. Ecclesiastes chapter 7 says, if you want to grow in wisdom, very free translation, if you want to grow in wisdom, don't go to a party. Go to a funeral. For it is in the house of mourning that you gain wisdom. You don't gain wisdom from a party. You gain fun and enjoyment and happiness, and all those things are worth having in the Bible. It'd be all for them. It's all for parties. But if you think you're going to get wisdom from parties, think again. There's no wisdom in a party. There's froth and bubble. There's superficiality, but there's no wisdom there. But you go to a funeral. You go and sit amongst the graves. You go and sit down with the mourners. You go and analyse what's happening from that viewpoint of life. You learn. The death of my mother, just as I was finishing university, was one of the most profound experiences in forcing me to grow up. You never perceive life the same after you have watched one who is close to you die and go to their funeral and readjust to life without them. The perspective of death is the perspective from which to gain wisdom. And so that's what the psalm is about. Let me give you the structure of it quickly so you can just see where we're at and the glance. Verses 1 to 4 of the psalm is the call to listen to his wisdom. Verse 5 and 6 set the question. Why should I fear when evil days come, when the wicked deceivers surround me, those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches? And then his answer is about the inadequacy of riches given the one fact of life, death, which occurs in verses 7 through to verse 13. The hopelessness of riches in the face of death. Verse 14, rather. Verse 15 has a one little glimmer of light which takes us into some hope in a very pessimistic world. Before verses 16 to 20, he returns to his challenge to people not to be overawed by the wealthy. Not to be overawed by them, because they ultimately are a nothing. Verse 12 and verse 20 give you a little chorus that goes in the song. Verse 12 is, but the man, despite his riches, doesn't endure. He is like the beasts that perish. And verse 20, a man who has riches without understanding is like the beasts that perish. Very negative. You see, Psalm 8 has this magnificent psalm about the place of man as the ruler of all creation. The first of the psalms we looked at. Psalm 49, man is like a beast that perishes. Takes you to the other spectrum, the other end of the biblical analysis of humanity. Well then, let's turn to it in sections as we go, because, not in sections rather, but to the theme of it. In verse 14, death is personified. We usually in Bible speak of the shepherd as being someone who's kind and gentle, who cares for the sheep, etc. But of course shepherds, by and large, eat a lot of lamb, if not mutton. Shepherds have the capacity not only for caring for the sheep, but eating them. And so death is like a shepherd, a carnivorous shepherd. If you're a sheep, you want to go into herbivorous shepherds. They're the best ones to look after you. Death is a carnivorous shepherd. It swallows up the sheep in death. It feeds upon us. That's a very sinister view of death. But here is the picture of death that this psalm has. It says, "In you ponder death, there are many points that the rich need to understand, and the poor need to understand about the rich. For there is no truth in their boasting," of verses 5 and 6. "They boast and they trust in their wealth, but they are deceived and deceivers." They are wicked deceivers, as they're described. They're self-deceived, really, because they trust in something which really has no strength at all. It's a lie. They are no better than anybody else. They are no greater than anybody else. They are funeral fodder, just like everybody else. They are cinders for the crematorium flu, like the rest of us. And so it is a complete deceit to think they are better, they are greater, they have got something that will stand the test of time, because there's no redemption in wealth. And verses 7 to 9 spells out, "Their wealth, however great, is insufficient to bribe the carnivorous shepherd called death." They can bribe councils, they can bribe judges, they can bribe politicians and police, but they can't bribe death. And more, they not only can't bribe death, they can't pay God. Their redemption is impossible. Redemption is the idea of, well known in the ancient world, of course, of buying a slave, buying a slave's freedom. And so Al here gets put into slavery, beaten in a war between Baxter and New College, held in slavery, and the friends of New College, if he has such things in New College, go up to Baxter and pay the Baxter people 3 footballs. About the life he's worth, to free him from the stocks that reside in Baxter. Now that is a redemption. We have bought his freedom. We have purchased it with 3 footballs blown up with hot air. Very fit symbol and image of Al. There is, you see, a redemption. There's the idea. Okay, now, what can a rich person pay to avoid death? Nothing. What value can he put in? $1 million? No. Two? No. If you're going to die, you're going to die. There is no money that you've got. And there is nothing that you own, doesn't matter how much you own, that is more valuable than yourself, is there? You can never own anything more valuable than yourself, so therefore you can never really trade your life off against something that you've got that's more valuable. You can never actually even own anything that is as valuable as you are. And so you've got nothing ever to trade to be able to redeem yourself from the just requirements of God in your death. So no matter how rich you are, you're never rich enough. And of course, just as you can't pay for yourself, you're never rich enough to pay off for anybody else's life either. No, no man is that wealthy. And so death is an absolute on mankind. The wealthy and the poor, without distinction, will meet their maker. And so verse 10, all the distinctions you see are deceptive, aren't they, between people? Because they're all lost in death. The rich, the poor, the wise, the fool, they all alike die. Because there's one absolute fundamental which says that they are all equal. All our life we want to talk about the equality of mankind. There's nothing equal in life except death. And there is absolutely no inequality in death. There's total equality at that point. Not in life, but in death. Wealth then is left to others. All the years you spent gathering and accumulating it, you leave it to your children who squander it, because they're spoiled brats having lived with it all their lives. And so, where is the profit in your greatness? You have a better grave? You have a bigger plaque? You have all your degrees scattered over it? What a nonsense. What makes you think anybody is going to bother reading them? Let alone be impressed that that bunch of ashes and a shin bone actually had them. Can you even be sure that they'll put the right ashes in the right little niche in this crematorium wall anyway? And here people come and plant roses outside your massive degreed plaque, not knowing that they've got the wrong ashes that they're honouring. There's no distinctions in death. You're all much the same. Very much the same. you can feed about the same number of roses. There's no endurance of wealth in death. Your power, your greatness does not endure just as you don't endure. Verse 11 and 12 picks it up, you see. Your only house, ultimately, is the tomb. You may have owned acres out at Vaucluse, but that's no use to you then. All you need then is 6 feet by 2 feet. You may have streets named after you. You may have cities named after you. You may have towns named after you. But really, it's of no consequence, because all you really have is the tomb, the coffin, the niche. And even then, that's not safe and secure. The ravages of time and erosion and of vandals and of war, even of politicians, they can do away with the tombstones. And they do. They destroy them, they wreck them, they push them somewhere else. You're just funeral fodder like the beasts, like the animals. It's not just that you're no better than any other mankind. He says, mankind's no better than the animal either. You lose, not only do you lose your wealth, not only do you lose your distinction, not only do you lose your humanity in death. Just like the beasts, verse 12 and verse 20. No different to the sheep, verse 14. You see, this is where materialistic atheism reduces us. They reduce it even in life. Because once you perceive there's nothing to this life other than material existence, other than the atomic structure that has made you up, once that's all there is, then of course you are no different to the animals. No better, no greater, no more significant. You may be more able, but you've got no greater rights or claims. And it's pushed for you in the animal liberation group in its extreme forms, like Peter Singer, the professor down in Melbourne University and professor of philosophy. He will push it forward and say, we've got to fight against speciesism. You've heard of sexism, you've heard of racism. He's actually against speciesism. The idea that humans have a right to do with animals what humans want to do. Because the animals have as much right as we have to do with us as they want to do, presumably. He has a very interesting and tenuous argument as to show how it's all right for the animals to eat vegetables and that not be speciesism. Can't really follow it myself, to say nothing of all the bacteria that you are killing in one way or another. But the end point is, you see, he wants to say that animals have as much right as we, because we're all the same. We are fundamentally the sludge that has popped out into the form we are, that primeval sludge which has evolved into you and me. And seeing we are all sludge, just like the cow and the dog, just like the whale and the snapper, just like the pigeon and the vulture, just like the cockroach and the maggot, we're all the same and have the same rights to life and happiness and the American way. Because we all perish. We're all funeral fodder. That is all we are. And death, you see, has this magnificent statement that says we are no different to the cockroaches. No difference to the maggots, to the dog, to the sheep. And of course there's no victory in death. The rich, the wealthy seem to have victory now, but when it comes to death they don't win anything. They don't have anything, because ultimately some others will stand up, verse 14. The upright, those who are still standing, will rule over them in the morning. Others will walk on your grave, as the old joke has it. The funeral director always comes out on top at the end. He is the one who walks on your grave. Don't despise the funeral director. He is the ultimate victor. And there's no splendour, of course, in death. The princely mansions, the houses, the lands that are mentioned in verses 14, 16, 17, you see them there. The rich, the splendour. It all goes with you to nothingness from your point of view, because your body is putrefying and decaying and rotting and breaking down into the humus of the soil, eaten out by the insects, and your marble splendour is an irrelevance at that point, complete and utter. For funeral fodder has no splendour. You can't take it with you, as the old saying has it. There are no pockets in shrouds. And so you go, as he describes you in verse 19, to be with your predecessors into the darkness, into the abyss where there is no light, as the NIV, I think, rightly adds, no light of life. The little bits of brackets there show that the words weren't in the original. And the idea of life, being alive, being where the light is, it's always going out, but you go finally to that place. And sums up his whole point, depressing psalm, isn't it? Verse 19. And saying the person who hasn't got understanding is indeed just like the beasts. He's no better than the beast. He's no different to the beast. Socrates or Plato, because the two merge, said, I think it's them that said it, the unreflective life is not worth living. To live without thought, without thinking, without reflecting upon it, is not to live any different to the beasts. Here is the view of the psalmist, that life without understanding death is to be like the beasts. They don't perceive and understand their own mortality, their own death, their own nonsense. It is our understanding that lifts us above them. But yet, if this is all the understanding we have, what does it lift us to? It lifts us to understand that we are just like them. Which is better off, the beast or the man? The beast doesn't think he's anything other than he is. The man thinks he's something more, namely he's the one who understands that he's no better than the beast. Big deal. You've got a long way, haven't you, in your understanding. And here is the existential pessimism of modern man. He has finally grasped hold of it. He has said there is only one absolute in the world, that is material existence. I can only believe what I can touch and smell and hear and feel and see. And all I can actually physically, empirically investigate shows that what life is made up of is tiny little parts of this. What life actually came from is this itself, because there can't be anything else by definition. And where life goes to is the grave, or if you want to do it on the universal scale, into some massive entropy where we wind down to nothingness. Given that view, what else can you be but pessimistic and depressed? Sartre and Camus in the novels and drama in Sartre's case, and Heidegger in the philosophy, and John Cage in the music, and the drama of people like Sartre or like Beckett. It's all that kind of depressing, absurd meaninglessness, because that is what they see. Life is meaningless. Life is absurd. It's meaningless, they write, that we are born. It's meaningless that we live. It's meaningless that we copulate. It's meaningless that we reproduce. It's meaningless that we die. Life is just one meaningless, absurd flicker in the universe of nothingness. It's all just a big hoax. It's a big accident. A bang happened somewhere for some reason that there is no reason. It just happened, and here we are. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. We're like the grand old Duke of York who marched his men up to march them down again. It's like the myth of Sisyphus who, rolling the stone up to the top, has it roll down the hill again, to roll it up to the top, to roll down again. And that's Camus' view of life, because he is taking seriously materialism. He is taking seriously that there is no God. He is taking seriously that the only reality of life is death. He takes it seriously enough to possibly suicide. This is a view of life that is possibly true. I don't think the humanist view of life has got any stance really of truth. I think it's a nonsense, just like I think the Marxists and Skinnerian and a few others are. I think they're hopelessly confused. Because they want to say there is nothing in the world, nothing in existence other than just existence. We just are, that's all. And then, having said that, they want to give you a whole range of values and morals to live by. It's the naturalistic fallacy of moving from is to ought that they all make while pointing the finger at Christians for trying the same trick. How can you come to a view of the importance and dignity of man, the significance of truth and justice, when what you believe is that there is no reason, no rhyme, no purpose, no meaning, there just is an accidental occurrence, that that's all we are? If that's all we are, and that's all the world is, then face the fact, as the existentialist does, and say, life is meaningless. Life is absurd. If all of life is only death, then all reflection of meaning, absolute values, is ridiculous nonsense. Here is a view that I think is possibly true. But If it is true, then truth is nonsense also. If it is true, then all there is life and death. There can be no meaningful analysis of it. And so the existentialist is never really interested so much in truth as in life. He's not interested in analysing what is, he's interested in living, because all there is, and it's to be lived. And here, of course, the whole possibility comes to collapse, because the existentialist's view is unlivable. You cannot actually do it, so Sartre joins up the Marxists. So Camus tries to suicide, and so it goes on. It's unlivable. It's unlivable to think that there is no fundamental difference between my wife and a cockroach. It is unlivable to think that I am as meaningless as an ant and as irrelevant as the seat I'm sitting on. It is an unlivable philosophy of life to presume that it doesn't matter whether I fought against Hitler or fought with him, whether I send Jews to gas chambers or not. To come to that view of the barbarity of Stalin or a Hitler is an unlivable view that mankind constantly turns its face against. Resolutely, I'm glad to say, turns its face against. Because I cannot really pay no attention to whether I kiss my wife or eat her. There is a difference, and it is unlivable to think it doesn't matter. And so existentialism, while maybe possibly true, is unlivable. And therefore, in its own terms, totally untrue. And so our psalmist gives a word to the rich and a word to the poor. To the rich he says, first of all, don't trust in your wealth. Don't boast in your riches. Don't see yourself as being something more than you are just because you have. Just because you've even achieved, because you are still only funeral fodder. Perceive yourself for what you are and don't be deluded, because you are really nothing. And to the poor, he says, don't envy, don't fear, don't be anxious, don't believe the deceptions of the rich. Oh, we believe the deceptions of the rich very much. We think that rich people are important. We think it is important for us to become rich. We are fearful of the great ones and the powerful ones. We honour them and bestow credit to them. But don't do it. For death makes the world's meanings nonsense. Don't believe upon it. Don't act upon it. But of course, most of us do. Most of us do because, well, that's what you're here for, isn't it? It's to make sure that in the system of this world you don't wind up as one of the poor. To make sure in the system of the world that you do wind up with a job which is satisfying and meaningful, which has a status of being one of the professional people within the community, and the assurance and security of a red brick prison out in the western suburbs with red tiles on top. Three kids in the state bank adding a story and a swimming pool later for you. We're committed to that lifestyle. And if you doubt whether we are, then watch people come in their suits and ties on the days when there's appointments for jobs. The transformation of the university student is fantastic. It's no real transformation, because that's what our heart was in all the time, although most frequently we don't even know it. We're just so used to winning that we're not conscious that what we're doing is aiming to win in a materialist rat race, which is meaningless because it ends in high-class coffins. It's meaningless. Here is the poverty of Western wealth, the poverty of our materialism. We live a life that is a lie. We say death is the only absolute, and so we live for wealth and power and meaning, and we live the life of an illusion that somehow we'll be important because we have, because we own. Somehow we'll be significant because we've got. Somehow we'll be secure. Somehow we'll be able to hedge ourselves against the danger of death. It's not riches. It's materialism that is the ethics of atheism. And atheism, materialism, alienates and divides people between the haves and the have-nots, and says the haves are important and the have-nots are not. It represses people. It leads some with starvation and others with gluttony. Always protesting that riches don't matter, we consistently put down people who are poor. But yet this psalm has a glimmer of light. Just a small one, and that wouldn't hurt our study to come to, would it? It's one of the greatest glimmers of light in the Old Testament. in the darkness of our ignorance, there is one hint that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that there is an outside to the cave, that there is another sphere that we can find out about, that we could possibly get to, that this is not the total sum of the meaning of existence or the total sum of existence, that there is something more to existence. You see, verse 7 says that redemption is impossible. No man is rich enough to redeem himself from death. No one is wealthy enough to pay off God. No man can liberate himself from this closed system world of existence. Death is the only answer, because redemption is impossible. But verse 14 points out that with God, all things are possible. For God can redeem. Indeed, the psalmist says, he will redeem me. He can pay, because God is rich enough. I don't own anything more valuable than me. But God owns much that is more valuable than I am. Much more. Even his own, of course, very self in particular, is more valuable than I am. And so he has things that he can pay to redeem me, that I do not have to ever redeem me. He has his life, his existence, himself. If he paid himself in death, then he could redeem me, and his value is so much greater than me, not only me but all of you as well, and not only all of you but the rest of mankind. If he cared to die, he could pay off for all of us. And of course that is the achievement of Jesus. The redemption that he achieved. This is what the New Testament is about. This salvation. This taking us out of prison. This releasing of the chains that have us in bondage. This taking us from the funeral pyre. For he, who was God, paid the ransom price for us. He purchased at the price which we could never afford, namely his own life. He purchased us by dying in our place, on our behalf, in our stead. And not only dying, of course, but overcoming death by rising again to new life, opening up for us that light, that glimmer of life beyond the grave, that says the tomb is not the last word. There is life beyond, and of which we have evidence, namely a man who came back from the tomb, a man who was God, and therefore for whom death could not rule. A man who was God, and therefore one who could pay the price to redeem other people from the tomb. The psalmist doesn't know about that as we know about that. But yet he keeps his confidence that God will somehow redeem him from the captivity that we are held in. The captivity of life called death. That then, of course, applies to our life as well. For once we perceive that we are not in a closed system, once we perceive there is a light at the end of the tunnel, once we perceive how to get out, then the whole character of how we now live in our prison changes, is transformed. We no longer need to live in meaningless and pessimism. We no longer need to live in absurdity, saying there's no point, all we're going to do is die. There's no significance in anything I do, because all that's going to happen is go down on a crematorium wall. There's no importance in me at all, because I'm just going to turn into dust and ashes. There's no significance in me any more than there is in a worm or a grub or a bird or a cow. Now that I perceive there is a world outside, and that I can be part of that because God has purchased me, then my significance as a person, my activities, my value is transformed. Not to chase, of course, after the world's distinctions of money, which are all an illusion, but after the distinctions of God and godliness, the values that are spelled out for us in the Sermon on the Mount, which we're going to look at in the next few weeks, when Jesus looks at the values and the priorities, the true judgments and piety of the kingdom of heaven. So let me turn you back to the card in the couple of minutes that we have, and invite you to take the time to write whatever comments, questions and queries you like in a moment. But to draw your attention to the back of the card where the prayer is printed. Because as you fill out those comments, etc., one of the things I'd like you to do is to reflect upon whether this is your prayer. Oh, word for word, it doesn't matter. What I've done is just given some words to clothe ideas. But are these the ideas of yours, and is this your prayer now? Or has been in the last few weeks, for the first time in your life, that you've actually turned back and committed your life to Jesus, who died for you? Because if you did, then I'd like you to join with me in praying it in the quietness of your own mind to God this day. And on the front of the card, you'll see there's a box up next to your name in the top right-hand corner. And I'd like you to tick that box and put your name and address there so that we could talk to you about it, and the staff members and myself. Because if this is your prayer, if this is the change that has come over your life at this stage, in this session of this year, then we'd love to help you and talk with you and share with you about the great things that have happened to you. And if it's your prayer today, then especially we'd like you to do that. So let's finish in prayer, shall we? And if you know the truth is in Jesus Christ, have become a Christian recently or want to become one this day, then pray with me in your mind. Dear God, I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life, and I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your Son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me, that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.